bloated and her skin was shiny looking and gray. It was the first dead thing of any size I'd ever seen. I remember Orin took a stick and touched the open eyes. We moved on down the fence toward the river. We were afraid to go near the wire because we thought it might still have electricity in it. But at the edge of what looked like a deep canal, the fence came to an end. The ground had simply dropped into the water here, and the fence along with it. We crossed the river and followed the new channel that cut directly into Dummy's land and headed straight for his pond, going into it lengthwise and forcing an outlet for itself at the other end, then twisting off until it joined up with the river farther on. You didn't doubt that most of Dummy's fish had been carried off, but those that hadn't been were free to come and go. Then I caught sight of Dummy. It scared me, seeing him. I motioned to the other fellows, and we all got down. Dummy was standing at the far side of the pond, near where the water was rushing out. He was just standing there, the saddest man I ever saw.
"I sure do feel sorry for old Dummy, though," my father said at supper a few weeks after. "Mind, the poor devil brought it on himself. But you can't help but be troubled for him."
Dad went on to say George Laycock saw Dummy's wife sitting in the sportsman's club with a big Mexican fellow.
"And that ain't the half of it."
Mother looked up at him sharply and then at me, but I just went on eating like I hadn't heard a thing. Dad said,
"Damn it to hell, B, the boy's old enough."
He'd changed a lot, Dummy had. He was never around any of the men anymore, not if he could help it. No one felt like joking with him either. Not since he'd chased Carl Lowe with a 2x4 stud after Carl tipped Dummy's hat off. But the worst of it was that Dummy was missing from work a day or two a week on the average now, and there was some talk of his being laid off.
"The man's going off the deep end," Dad said. "Clear crazy if you don't watch out."
Then on a Sunday afternoon just before my birthday, Dad and I were cleaning the garage. It was a warm, drifty day. You could see the dust hanging in the air. Mother came to the back door and said, "Del, it's for you. I think it's Vern." I followed Dad in to wash up. When he was through talking, he put the phone down and turned to us.
"It's Dummy," he said. "Did in his wife with a hammer and drowned himself. Vern just heard it in town."
When we got there, cars were parked all around. The gate to the pasture stood open, and I could see tire marks that led onto the pond. The screen door was propped ajar with a box, and there was this lean, pock-faced man in slacks and sports shirt, and wearing a shoulder holster. He watched Dad and me get out of the car.
"I was his friend," Dad said to the man.
The man shook his head.
"Don't care who you are. Clear off unless you've got business here." "Did they find him?" Dad said.
"They're dragging,"
the man said and adjusted the fit of his gun.
"All right if we walk down. I knew him pretty well."
The man said,
"Take your chances. They chase you off, don't say you wasn't warned."
We went on across the pasture, taking pretty much the same route we had the day we tried fishing. There were motorboats going on the pond, dirty fluffs of exhaust hanging over it. You could see where the high water had cut away the ground and carried off trees and rocks. The two boats had uniformed men in them, and they were going back and forth, one man steering and the other man handling the rope and hooks. An ambulance waited on the gravel beach where we'd set ourselves to cast for Dummy's bass. Two men in white lounged against the back, smoking cigarettes. One of the motorboats cut off. We all looked up. The man in back stood up and started heaving on his rope. After a time, an arm came out of the water. It looked like the hooks had gotten Dummy in the side. The arm went back down and then it came out again, along with a bundle of something. "It's not him," I thought. "It's something else that has been in there for years." The man in front of the boat moved to the back, and together the two men hauled the dripping thing over the side. I looked at Dad. His face was funny the way it was set.
"Women," he said.
He said, That's what the wrong kind of woman can do to you, Jack. But I don't think Dad really believed it. I think he just didn't know who to blame or what to say. It seemed to me everything took a bad turn for my father after that. Just like Dummy, he wasn't the same man anymore. That arm coming up and going back down in the water, it was like so long to good times and hello to bad. Because it was nothing but that all the years after Dummy drowned himself in that dark water. Is that what happens when a friend dies? Bad luck for the pals he left behind? But as I said, Pearl Harbor and having to move back to his dad's place didn't do my dad one bit of good either.
A serious talk.
Vera's car was there, no others, and Bert gave thanks for that. He pulled into the drive and stopped beside the pie he'd dropped the night before. It was still there, the aluminum pan upside down, a halo of pumpkin filling on the pavement. It was the day after Christmas. He'd come on Christmas Day to visit his wife and children. Vera had warned him beforehand. She'd told him the score. She'd said he had to be out by 6 o'clock because her friend and his children were coming for dinner. They had sat in the living room and solemnly opened the presents Bert had brought over. They had opened his packages while other packages wrapped in festive paper lay piled under the tree waiting for after 6 o'clock. He had watched the children open their gifts, waited while Vera undid the ribbon on hers. He saw her slip off the paper, lift the lid, take out the cashmere sweater.
"It's nice," she said. "Thank you, Bert."
"Try it on,"
his daughter said.
"Put it on," his son said.
Bert looked at his son, grateful for his backing him up. She did try it on. Vera went into the bedroom and came out with it on.
"It's nice," she said.
"It's nice on you," Bert said, and felt a welling in his chest. He opened his gifts. From Vera, a gift certificate at Sondheim's men's store. From his daughter, a matching comb and brush. From his son, a ballpoint pen. Vera served sodas, and they did a little talking, but mostly they looked at the tree. Then his daughter got up and began setting the dining room table, and his son went off to his room. But Bert liked it where he was. He liked it in front of the fireplace, a glass in his hand, his house, his home. Then Vera went into the kitchen. From time to time, his daughter walked into the dining room with something for the table. Bert watched her. He watched her fold the linen napkins into the wine glasses. He watched her put a slender vase in the middle of the table. He watched her lower a flower into the vase, doing it ever so carefully. A small wax and sawdust log burned on the grate. A carton of five more sat ready on the hearth. He got up from the sofa and put them all in the fireplace. He watched until they flamed. Then he finished his soda and made for the patio door. On the way, he saw the pies lined up on the sideboard. He stacked them in his arms, all six, one for every 10 times she had ever betrayed him. In the driveway, in the dark, he'd let one fall as he fumbled with the door. The front door was permanently locked since the night his key had broken off inside it. He went around to the back. There was a wreath on the patio door. He rapped on the glass. Vera was in her bathrobe. She looked out at him and frowned. She opened the door a little. Bert said, "I want to apologize to you for last night. I want to apologize to the kids, too." Vera said,
"They're not here."
She stood in the doorway and he stood on the patio next to the philodendron plant. He pulled at some lint on his sleeve. She said,
"I can't take any more. You tried to burn the house down."
"I did not."
"You did. Everybody here was a witness."
He said, "Can I come in and talk about it?"
She drew the robe together at her throat and moved back inside. She said, "I have to go somewhere in an hour."
He looked around. The tree blinked on and off. There was a pile of colored tissue paper and shiny boxes at one end of the sofa.
A turkey carcass sat on a platter in the center of the dining room table, the leathery remains and a bed of parsley as if in a horrible nest. A cone of ash filled the fireplace. There were some empty Shasta Cola cans in there, too. A trail of smoke stains rose up the bricks to the mantel, where the wood that stopped them was scorched black. He turned around and went back to the kitchen. He said, "What time did your friend leave last night?" She said, "If you're going to start that, you can go right now." He pulled a chair out and sat down at the kitchen table in front of the big ashtray. He closed his eyes and opened them. He moved the curtain aside and looked out at the backyard. He saw a bicycle without a front wheel standing upside down. He saw weeds growing along the redwood fence. She ran water into a saucepan. "Do you remember Thanksgiving?" she said. "I said then that was the last holiday you were going to wreck for us, eating bacon and eggs instead of turkey at 10 o'clock at night."
"I know it," he said. "I said I'm sorry."
"Sorry isn't good enough." The pilot light was out again. She was at the stove trying to get the gas going under the pan of water.
"Don't burn yourself," he said. "Don't catch yourself on fire."
He considered her robe catching fire, him jumping up from the table, throwing her down onto the floor and rolling her over and over into the living room, where he would cover her with his body. Or should he run to the bedroom for a blanket?
"Vera?"
She looked at him.
"Do you have anything to drink? I could use a drink this morning."
"There's some vodka in the freezer."
"When did you start keeping vodka in the freezer?"
"Don't ask."
"Okay," he said. "I won't ask."
He got out the vodka and poured some into a cup he found on the counter. She said, "Are you just going to drink it like that, out of a cup?" She said, "Jesus, Bert. What do you want to talk about anyway? I told you I have some place to go. I have a flute lesson at 1 o'clock.
"Are you still taking flute?"
"I just said so. What is it? Tell me what's on your mind and then I have to get ready."
"I wanted to say I was sorry."
She said, "You said that."
He said, "If you have any juice, I'll mix it with this vodka."
She opened the refrigerator and moved things around. "There's cranapple juice," she said.
"That's fine," he said.
"I'm going to the bathroom," she said. He drank the cup of cranapple juice and vodka. He lit a cigarette and tossed the match into the big ashtray that always sat on the kitchen table. He studied the butts in it. Some of them were Vera's brand, and some of them weren't. Some even were lavender-colored. He got up and dumped it all under the sink. The ashtray was not really an ashtray. It was a big dish of stoneware they'd bought from a bearded potter on the mall in Santa Clara. He rinsed it out and dried it. He put it back on the table. And then he ground out his cigarette in it. The water on the stove began to bubble just as the phone began to ring. He heard her open the bathroom door and call to him through the living room.
"Answer that. I'm about to get into the shower."
The kitchen phone was on the counter in a corner behind the roasting pan. He moved the roasting pan and picked up the receiver.
"Is Charlie there?"
the voice said.
"No,"
Bert said.
"Okay,"
the voice said. While he was seeing to the coffee, the phone rang again.
"Charlie?"
"Not here,"
Bert said. This time he left the receiver off the hook. Vera came back into the kitchen wearing jeans and a sweater and brushing her hair. He spooned the instant into the cups of hot water and then spilled some vodka into his. He carried the cups over to the table. She picked up the receiver, listened. She said, "What's this? Who was on the phone?"
"Nobody," he said. "Who smokes colored cigarettes?"
"I do."
"I didn't know you did that."
"Well, I do." She sat across from him and drank her coffee. They smoked and used the ashtray. There were things he wanted to say, grieving things, consoling things, things like that. "I'm smoking 3 packs a day," Vera said. "I mean, if you really want to know what goes on around here."
God almighty,
Bert said. Vera nodded.
I didn't come over here to hear that,
he said. What did you come over here to hear, then? You want to hear the house burned down?
Vera, he said, it's Christmas. That's why I came.
It's the day after Christmas, she said. Christmas has come and gone, she said. I don't ever want to see another one.
What about me?
He said.
You think I look forward to the holidays?
The phone rang again. Bert picked it up.
It's someone wanting Charlie, he said.
What?
Charlie, Bert said.
Vera took the phone. She kept her back to him as she talked. Then she turned to him and said, I'll take this call in the bedroom. So would you please hang up after I've picked it up in there? I can tell, so hang it up when I say. He took the receiver. She left the kitchen. He held the receiver to his ear and listened. He heard nothing. Then he heard a man clear his throat. Then he heard Vera pick up the other phone. She shouted, Okay, Bert. I have it now, Bert. He put down the receiver and stood looking at it. He opened the silverware drawer and pushed things around inside. He opened another drawer. He looked in the sink. He went into the dining room and got the carving knife. He held it under hot water until the grease broke and ran off. He wiped the blade on his sleeve. He moved to the phone, doubled the cord, and sawed through without any trouble at all. He examined the ends of the cord. Then he shoved the phone back into its corner behind the roasting pan. She came in. She said, The phone went dead. Did you do anything to the telephone? She looked at the phone and then picked it up from the counter.
Son of a bitch! She screamed.
She screamed, Out! Out where you belong! She was shaking the phone at him. That's it. I'm going to get a restraining order. That's what I'm going to get. The phone made a ding when she banged it down on the counter. I'm going next door to call the police if you don't get out of here now. He picked up the ashtray. He held it by its edge. He posed with it like a man preparing to hurl the discus. Please, she said. That's our ashtray. He left through the patio door. He was not certain, but he thought he had proved something. He hoped he had made something clear. The thing was, they had to have a serious talk soon. There were things that needed talking about, important things that had to be discussed. They'd talk again. Maybe after the holidays were over and things got back to normal. He'd tell her the goddamn ashtray was a goddamn dish, for example. He stepped around the pie in the driveway and got back into his car. He started the car and put it into reverse. It was hard managing until he put the ashtray down. The calm.
I was getting a haircut. I was in the chair and three men were sitting along the wall across from me. Two of the men waiting I'd never seen before, but one of them I recognized, though I couldn't exactly place him. I kept looking at him as the barber worked on my hair. The man was moving a toothpick around in his mouth, a heavy-set man, short, wavy hair. And then I saw him in a cap and uniform, little eyes watchful in the lobby of a bank. Of the other two, one was considerably the older, with a full head of curly gray hair. He was smoking. The third, though not so old, was nearly bald on top, but the hair at the sides hung over his ears. He had on logging boots, pants shiny with machine oil. The barber put a hand on top of my head to turn me for a better look. Then he said to the guard, Did you get your deer, Charles? I liked this barber. We weren't acquainted well enough to call each other by name, but when I came in for a haircut, he knew me. He knew I used to fish, so we'd talk fishing. I don't think he hunted, but he could talk on any subject. In this regard, he was a good barber. Bill, it's a funny story. The damnedest thing, the guard said. He took out the toothpick and laid it in the ashtray. He shook his head. I did and I didn't. So, yes and no to your question. I didn't like the man's voice. For a guard, the voice didn't fit. It wasn't the voice you'd expect. The two other men looked up. The older man was turning the pages of a magazine, smoking, and the other fellow was holding a newspaper. They put down what they were looking at and turned to listen to the guard.
"Go on, Charles," the barber said. "Let's hear it."
The barber turned my head again and went back to work with his clippers.
"We were up on Fickle Ridge, my old man and me and the kid. We were hunting those draws. My old man was stationed at the head of one, and me and the kid were at the head of another. The kid had a hangover, goddamn his hide. The kid, he was green around the gills and drank water all day, mine and his both. It was in the afternoon, and we'd been out since daybreak. But we had our hopes. We figured the hunters down below would move a deer in our direction. So we were sitting behind a log and watching the draw when we heard this shooting down in the valley."
"There's orchards down there," said the fellow with the newspaper. He was fidgeting a lot and kept crossing a leg, swinging his boot for a time, and then crossing his legs the other way. "Those deer hang out around those orchards."
"That's right," said the guard. "They'll go in there at night, the bastards, and eat those little green apples. Well, we heard this shooting, and we're just sitting there on our hands when this big old buck comes out of the underbrush not 100 feet away. The kid sees him the same time I do, of course, and he throws down and starts banging. The knothead. That old buck wasn't in any danger. Not from the kid, as it turns out. But he can't tell where the shots are coming from. He doesn't know which way to jump. Then I get off a shot. But in all the commotion, I just stun him."
"Stunned him?" the barber said.
"You know, stun him," the guard said. "It was a gut shot. It just, like, stuns him. So he drops his head and begins this trembling. He trembles all over. The kid's still shooting. Me, I felt like I was back in Korea. So I shot again, but missed. Then old Mr. Buck moves back into the brush. But now, by God, he doesn't have any oomph left in him. The kid has emptied his goddamn gun all to no purpose. But I hit solid. I'd rammed one right in his guts. That's what I meant by stunned him."
"Then what?" said the fellow with the newspaper, who had rolled it and was tapping it against his knee. "Then what? You must have trailed him. They find a hard place to die every time."
"But you trailed him?" the older man asked, though it wasn't really a question. "I did. Me and the kid, we trailed him. But the kid wasn't good for much. He gets sick on the trail, slows us down. That chucklehead."
The guard had to laugh now, thinking about that situation. Drinking beer and chasing all night, then saying he can hunt deer.
"He knows better now, by God. But sure, we trailed him. A good trail, too. Blood on the ground and blood on the leaves, blood everywhere. Never seen a buck with so much blood. I don't know how the sucker kept going."
"Sometimes they'll go forever," the fellow with the newspaper said. "They find them a hard place to die every time."
"I chewed the kid out for missing his shot, and when he smarted off at me, I cuffed him a good one, right here."
The guard pointed to the side of his head and grinned.
"I boxed his goddamn ears for him, that goddamn kid. He's not too old. He needed it. So the point is, it got too dark to trail, what with the kid laying back to vomit and all."
"Well, the coyotes will have that deer by now," the fellow with the newspaper said. "Them and the crows and the buzzards." He unrolled the newspaper, smoothed it all the way out, and put it off to one side. He crossed a leg again. He looked around at the rest of us and shook his head. The older man had turned in his chair and was looking out the window. He lit a cigarette.
"I figure so," the guard said. "Pity, too. He was a big old son of a bitch. So, in answer to your question, Bill, I both got my deer and I didn't. But we had venison on the table anyway, because it turns out the old man has got himself a little spike in the meantime. Already has him back to camp, hanging up and gutted slick as a whistle, liver, heart, and kidneys, wrapped in waxed paper and already setting in the cooler. A spike. Just a little bastard. But the old man, he was tickled."
The guard looked around the shop as if remembering. Then he picked up his toothpick and stuck it back in his mouth. The older man put his cigarette out and turned to the guard. He drew a breath and said, "You ought to be out there right now looking for that deer instead of in here getting a haircut." "You can't talk like that," the guard said. "You old fart, I've seen you someplace."
"I've seen you too," the old fellow said.
"Boys, that's enough. This is my barber shop," the barber said.
"I ought to box your ears," the old fellow said.
"You ought to try it," the guard said.
"Charles," the barber said.
The barber put his comb and scissors on the counter and his hands on my shoulders, as if he thought I was thinking to spring from the chair into the middle of it.
"Albert, I've been cutting Charles's head of hair, and his boys, too, for years now. I wish you wouldn't pursue this."
The barber looked from one man to the other and kept his hands on my shoulders.
"Take it outside," the fellow with the newspaper said, flushed and hoping for something. "That'll be enough," the barber said. "Charles, I don't want to hear anything more on the subject. Albert, you're next in line, now."
The barber turned to the fellow with the newspaper.
"I don't know you from Adam, mister, but I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't put your oar in."
The guard got up. He said,
"I think I'll come back for my cut later. Right now the company leaves something to be desired."
The guard went out and pulled the door closed, hard. The old fellow sat smoking his cigarette. He looked out the window. He examined something on the back of his hand. He got up and put on his hat.
"I'm sorry, Bill," the old fellow said. "I can go a few more days."
"That's all right, Albert," the barber said. When the old fellow went out, the barber stepped over to the window to watch him go.
"Albert's about dead from emphysema," the barber said from the window. "We used to fish together. He taught me salmon inside out. The women, they used to crawl all over that old boy. He's picked up a temper, though. But in all honesty, there was provocation."
The old man with the newspaper couldn't sit still. He was on his feet and moving around, stopping to examine everything. The hat rack, the photos of Bill and his friends, the calendar from the hardware, showing scenes for each month of the year. He flipped every page. He even went so far as to stand and scrutinize Bill's barbering license, which was up on the wall in a frame. Then he turned and said, "I'm going too." And out he went, just like he said.
"Well, do you want me to finish barbering this hair or not?" the barber said to me, as if I was the cause of everything.
The barber turned me in the chair to face the mirror. He put a hand to either side of my head. He positioned me a last time, and then he brought his head down next to mine. We looked into the mirror together, his hand still framing my head. I was looking at myself, and he was looking at me too. But if the barber saw something, he didn't offer comment. He ran his fingers through my hair. He did it slowly, as if thinking about something else. He ran his fingers through my hair. He did it tenderly, as a lover would. That was in Crescent City, California, up near the Oregon border. I left soon after. But today I was thinking of that place, of Crescent City, and of how I was trying out a new life there with my wife, and how, in the barber's chair that morning, I had made up my mind to go. I was thinking today about the calm I felt when I closed my eyes and let the barber's fingers move through my hair. The sweetness of those fingers. The hair already starting to grow.
Popular Mechanics. Early that day, the weather turned, and the snow was melting into dirty water. Streaks of it ran down from the little shoulder-high window that faced the backyard. Cars slushed by on the street outside where it was getting dark. But it was getting dark on the inside, too. He was in the bedroom pushing clothes into a suitcase when she came to the door.
"I'm glad you're leaving. I'm glad you're leaving,"
she said. Do you hear? He kept on putting his things into the suitcase.
Son of a bitch. I'm so glad you're leaving.
She began to cry.
You can't even look me in the face, can you?
Then she noticed the baby's picture on the bed and picked it up. He looked at her and she wiped her eyes and stared at him before turning and going back to the living room.
Bring that back, he said.
Just get your things and get out, she said.
He did not answer. He fastened the suitcase, put on his coat, looked around the bedroom before turning off the light. Then he went out to the living room. She stood in the doorway of the little kitchen, holding the baby.
I want the baby, he said.
Are you crazy?
No, but I want the baby. I'll get someone to come by for his things.
You're not touching this baby, she said.
The baby had begun to cry, and she uncovered the blanket from around his head.
Oh,
she said, looking at the baby. He moved toward her.
For God's sake, she said.
She took a step back into the kitchen.
I want the baby.
Get out of here.
She turned and tried to hold the baby over in a corner behind the stove. But he came up. He reached across the stove and tightened his hands on the baby.
Let go of him, he said.
Get away,
she cried. The baby was red-faced and screaming. In the scuffle, they knocked down a flower pot that hung behind the stove. He crowded her into the wall then, trying to break her grip. He held on to the baby and pushed with all his weight.
Let go of him, he said.
Don't, she said. You're hurting the baby, she said.
I'm not hurting the baby, he said.
The kitchen window gave no light. In the near dark, he worked on her fisted fingers with one hand, and with the other he gripped the screaming baby up under an arm near the shoulder. She felt her fingers being forced open. She felt the baby going from her.
No!
She screamed just as her hands came loose. She would have it, this baby. She grabbed for the baby's other arm. She caught the baby around the wrist and leaned back. But he would not let go. He felt the baby slipping out of his hands and he pulled back very hard. In this manner, the issue was decided. Everything stuck to him. She's in Milan for Christmas and wants to know what it was like when she was a kid. Tell me, she says. Tell me what it was like when I was a kid. She sips Strega, waits, eyes him closely. She is a cool, slim, attractive girl, a survivor from top to bottom.
That was a long time ago. That was 20 years ago, he says.
You can remember, she says. Go on.
What do you want to hear? He says. What else can I tell you? I could tell you about something that happened when you were a baby. It involves you, he says, but only in a minor way.
Tell me, she says. But first fix us another so you won't have to stop in the middle.
He comes back from the kitchen with drinks, settles into his chair, begins.
They were kids themselves, but they were crazy in love, this 18-year-old boy and this 17-year-old girl when they married. Not all that long afterwards, they had a daughter. The baby came along in late November during a cold spell that just happened to coincide with the peak of the waterfowl season. The boy loved to hunt, you see. That's part of it. The boy and girl, husband and wife, father and mother, they lived in a little apartment under a dentist's office. Each night they cleaned the dentist's place upstairs in exchange for rent and utilities. In summer they were expected to maintain the lawn and the flowers. In winter the boy shoveled snow and spread rock salt on the walks. Are you still with me? Are you getting the picture?
I am, she says.
That's good, he says. So one day the dentist finds out they were using his letterhead for their personal correspondence. But that's another story.
He gets up from his chair and looks out the window. He sees the tile rooftops and the snow that is falling steadily on them. "Tell the story," she says.
The two kids were very much in love. On top of this, they had great ambitions. They were always talking about the things they were going to do and the places they were going to go. Now the boy and girl slept in the bedroom, and the baby slept in the living room. Let's say the baby was about 3 months old and had only just begun to sleep through the night. On this one Saturday night, after finishing his work upstairs, the boy stayed in the dentist's office and called an old hunting friend of his father's. "Carl," he said when the man picked up the receiver. "Believe it or not, I'm a father."
"Congratulations," Carl said. "How is the wife?"
"She's fine, Carl. Everybody's fine."
"That's good," Carl said. "I'm glad to hear it. But if you called about going hunting, I'll tell you something. The geese are flying to beat the band. I don't think I've ever seen so many. Got 5 today, going back in the morning. So come along if you want to."
"I want to," the boy said.
The boy hung up the telephone and went downstairs to tell the girl. She watched while he laid out his things. Hunting coat, shell bag, boots, socks, hunting cap, long underwear, pump gun.
"What time will you be back?" the girl said.
"Probably around noon," the boy said. "But maybe as late as 6 o'clock. Would that be too late?"
"It's fine," she said. "The baby and I will get along fine. You go and have some fun. When you get back, we'll dress the baby up and go visit Sally."
The boy said, "Sounds like a good idea."
Sally was the girl's sister. She was striking. I don't know if you've seen pictures of her. The boy was a little in love with Sally, just as he was a little in love with Betsy, who was another sister the girl had. The boy used to say to the girl, "If we weren't married, I could go for Sally."
"What about Betsy?" the girl used to say.
"I hate to admit it, but I truly feel she's better looking than Sally and me. What about Betsy?"
"Betsy, too," the boy used to say.
After dinner, he turned up the furnace and helped her bathe the baby. He marveled again at the infant, who had half his features and half the girl's. He powdered the tiny body. He powdered between fingers and toes. He emptied the bath into the sink and went upstairs to check the air. It was overcast and cold. The grass, what there was of it, looked like canvas, stiff and gray under the street light. Snow lay in piles beside the walk. A car went by. He heard sand under the tires. He let himself imagine what it might be like tomorrow, geese beating the air over his head, shotgun plunging against his shoulder. Then he locked the door and went downstairs. In bed, they tried to read, but both of them fell asleep, she first, letting the magazine sink to the quilt. It was the baby's cries that woke him up. The light was on out there, and the girl was standing next to the crib, rocking the baby in her arms. She put the baby down, turned out the light, and came back to the bed. He heard the baby cry. This time the girl stayed where she was. The baby cried fitfully and stopped. The boy listened, then dozed. But the baby's cries woke him again. The living room light was burning. He sat up and turned on the lamp. "I don't know what's wrong," the girl said, walking back and forth with the baby. "I've changed her and fed her, but she keeps on crying. I'm so tired, I'm afraid I might drop her." "You come back to bed," the boy said. "I'll hold her for a while."
He got up and took the baby, and the girl went to lie down again. "Just rock her for a few minutes," the girl said from the bedroom. "Maybe she'll go back to sleep." The boy sat on the sofa and held the baby. He jiggled it in his lap until he got its eyes to close, his own eyes closing right along. He rose carefully and put the baby back in the crib. It was 4:15, which gave him 45 minutes. He crawled into bed and dropped off. But a few minutes later, the baby was crying again, and this time they both got up. The boy did a terrible thing. He swore.
"For God's sake, what's the matter with you?" the girl said to the boy. "Maybe she's sick or something."
Maybe we shouldn't have given her the bath.
The boy picked up the baby. The baby kicked its feet and smiled.
Look, the boy said, I really don't think there's anything wrong with her.
How do you know that? The girl said. Here, let me have her.
I know I ought to give her something, but I don't know what it's supposed to be.
The girl put the baby down again. The boy and the girl looked at the baby, and the baby began to cry. The girl took the baby.
Baby, baby, the girl said with tears in her eyes.
Probably it's something on her stomach, the boy said. The girl didn't answer. She went on rocking the baby, paying no attention to the boy. The boy waited. He went to the kitchen and put on water for coffee. He drew his woolen underwear on over his shorts and t-shirt, buttoned up, then got into his clothes.
What are you doing? The girl said.
Going hunting, the boy said.
I don't think you should, she said. I don't want to be left alone with her like this.
Carl's planning on me going, the boy said. We've planned it.
I don't care about what you and Carl planned, she said. And I don't care about Carl either. I don't even know Carl.
You've met Carl before. You know him, the boy said.
What do you mean you don't know him?
That's not the point, and you know it, the girl said.
What's the point, the boy said.
The point is we planned it.
The girl said, I'm your wife. This is your baby. She's sick or something. Look at her. Why else is she crying?
I know you're my wife, the boy said.
The girl began to cry. She put the baby back in the crib.
But the baby started up again.
The girl dried her eyes on the sleeve of her nightgown and picked the baby up.
The boy laced up his boots. He put on his shirt, his sweater, his coat. The kettle whistled on the stove in the kitchen.
You're going to have to choose, the girl said. Carl or us?
I mean it.
What do you mean? The boy said.
You heard what I said, the girl said. If you want a family, you're going to have to choose.
They stared at each other. Then the boy took up his hunting gear and went outside. He started the car. He went around to the car windows and, making a job of it, scraped away the ice. He turned off the motor and sat a while. And then he got out and went back inside. The living room light was on. The girl was asleep on the bed. The baby was asleep beside her. The boy took off his boots. Then he took off everything else. In his socks and his long underwear, he sat on the sofa and read the Sunday paper. The girl and the baby slept on. After a while, the boy went to the kitchen and started frying bacon. The girl came out in her robe and put her arms around the boy.
Hey, the boy said.
I'm sorry, the girl said.
It's all right, the boy said.
I didn't mean to snap like that.
It was my fault, he said.
You sit down, the girl said. How does a waffle sound with bacon?
Sounds great, the boy said.
She took the bacon out of the pan and made the waffle batter. He sat at the table and watched her move around the kitchen. She put a plate in front of him with bacon, a waffle. He spread butter and poured syrup. But when he started to cut, he turned the plate into his lap.
I don't believe it, he said, jumping up from the table.
If you could see yourself, the girl said. The boy looked down at himself, at everything stuck to his underwear.
I was starved, he said, shaking his head.
You were starved, she said, laughing. He peeled off the woolen underwear and threw it at the bathroom door. Then he opened his arms and the girl moved into them.
We won't fight anymore, she said.
The boy said, we won't. He gets up from his chair and refills their glasses.
That's it, he says.
End of story.
I admit it's not much of a story.
I was interested, she says. He shrugs and carries his drink over to the window. It's dark now, but still snowing.
Things change, he says. I don't know how they do, but they do without your realizing it or wanting them to.
Yes, that's true, only... But she does not finish what she started. She drops the subject.
In the window's reflection, he sees her study her nails. Then she raises her head. Speaking brightly, she asks if he is going to show her the city after all. He says,
"Put your boots on and let's go."
But he stays by the window, remembering. They had laughed. They had leaned on each other and laughed until the tears had come, while everything else, the cold and where he'd go in it, was outside. For a while, anyway. What we talk about when we talk about love. My friend Mel McGinnis was talking. Mel McGinnis is a cardiologist, and sometimes that gives him the right. The four of us were sitting around his kitchen table drinking gin. Sunlight filled the kitchen from the big window behind the sink. There were Mel and me and his second wife Teresa, Terry we called her, and my wife Laura. We lived in Albuquerque then, but we were all from somewhere else. There was an ice bucket on the table. The gin and the tonic water kept going around, and we somehow got on the subject of love. Mel thought real love was nothing less than spiritual love. He said he'd spent 5 years in a seminary before quitting to go to medical school. He said he still looked back on those years in the seminary as the most important years in his life. Terry said the man she lived with before she lived with Mel loved her so much he tried to kill her. Then Terry said,
"He beat me up one night. He dragged me around the living room by my ankles. He kept saying, 'I love you. I love you, you bitch.' He went on dragging me around the living room. My head kept knocking on things."
Terry looked around the table.
"What do you do with love like that?"
She was a bone-thin woman with a pretty face, dark eyes, and brown hair that hung down her back. She liked necklaces made of turquoise and long pendant earrings.
"My God, don't be silly. That's not love and you know it," Mel said. "I don't know what you'd call it, but I sure know you wouldn't call it love."
"Say what you want to, but I know it was," Terry said. "It may sound crazy to you, but it's true just the same. People are different, Mel. Sure, sometimes he may have acted crazy, okay. But he loved me. In his own way, maybe, but he loved me. There was love there, Mel. Don't say there wasn't."
Mel let out his breath. He held his glass and turned to Laura and me. "The man threatened to kill me," Mel said. He finished his drink and reached for the gin bottle. "Terry's a romantic. Terry's of the kick me so I'll know you love me school. Terry, hon, don't look that way." Mel reached across the table and touched Terry's cheek with his fingers. He grinned at her.
"Now he wants to make up," Terry said.
"Make up what?" Mel said. "What is there to make up? I know what I know, that's all."
"How'd we get started on this subject anyway?" Terry said.
She raised her glass and drank from it.
"Mel always has love on his mind," she said. "Don't you, honey?"
She smiled, and I thought that was the last of it.
"I just wouldn't call Ed's behavior love. That's all I'm saying, honey," Mel said. "What about you guys?" Mel said to Laura and me. "Does that sound like love to you?"
"I'm the wrong person to ask," I said. "I didn't even know the man. I've only heard his name mentioned in passing. I wouldn't know. You'd have to know the particulars. But I think what you're saying is that love is an absolute."
Mel said, "The kind of love I'm talking about is, the kind of love I'm talking about, you don't try to kill people."
Laura said,
"I don't know anything about Ed, or anything about the situation, but who can judge anyone else's situation?"
I touched the back of Laura's hand. She gave me a quick smile. I picked up Laura's hand. It was warm, the nails polished, perfectly manicured. I encircled the broad wrist with my fingers, and I held her.
"When I left, he drank rat poison," Terry said.
She clasped her arms with her hands.
They took him to the hospital in Santa Fe. That's where we lived then, about 10 miles out. They saved his life. But his gums went crazy from it. I mean, they pulled away from his teeth. After that, his teeth stood out like fangs. My God, Terry said. She waited a minute, then let go of her arms and picked up her glass.
What people won't do,
Laura said.
He's out of the action now, Mel said. He's dead. Mel handed me the saucer of limes. I took a section, squeezed it over my drink, and stirred the ice cubes with my finger.
It gets worse, Terry said. He shot himself in the mouth, but he bungled that too, poor Ed, she said.
Terry shook her head. Poor Ed, nothing, Mel said. He was dangerous. Mel was 45 years old. He was tall and rangy with curly soft hair. His face and arms were brown from the tennis he played. When he was sober, his gestures, all his movements, were precise, very careful.
He did love me, though, Mel. Grant me that, Terry said. That's all I'm asking. He didn't love me the way you love me. I'm not saying that, but he loved me. You can grant me that, can't you?
What do you mean he bungled it? I said. Laura leaned forward with her glass. She put her elbows on the table and held her glass in both hands. She glanced from Mel to Terry and waited with a look of bewilderment on her open face, as if amazed that such things happened to people you were friendly with. How'd he bungle it when he killed himself? I said.
I'll tell you what happened, Mel said. He took this .22 pistol he'd bought to threaten Terry and me with.
Oh, I'm serious. The man was always threatening. You should have seen the way we lived in those days, like fugitives. I even bought a gun myself. Can you believe it? A guy like me. But I did. I bought one for self-defense and carried it in the glove compartment. Sometimes I'd have to leave the apartment in the middle of the night. To go to the hospital, you know. Terry and I weren't married then, and my first wife had the house and kids, the dog, everything. And Terry and I were living in this apartment here. Sometimes, as I say, I'd get a call in the middle of the night and have to go to the hospital at 2 or 3 in the morning. It'd be dark out there in the parking lot, and I'd break into a sweat before I could even get to my car. I never knew if he was going to come up out of the shrubbery or from behind a car and start shooting. I mean, the man was crazy. He was capable of wiring a bomb, anything. He used to call my service at all hours and say he needed to talk to the doctor, and when I'd return the call, he'd say, "Son of a bitch, your days are numbered." Little things like that. It was scary, I'm telling you.
I still feel sorry for him, Terry said.
It sounds like a nightmare, Laura said. But what exactly happened after he shot himself?
Laura's a legal secretary. We'd met in a professional capacity. Before we knew it, it was a courtship. She's 35, 3 years younger than I am. In addition to being in love, we like each other and enjoy one another's company. She's easy to be with.
What happened? Laura said.
Mel said, he shot himself in the mouth in his room. Someone heard the shot and told the manager. They came in with a pass key, saw what had happened, and called an ambulance. I happened to be there when they brought him in, alive but past recall. The man lived for 3 days. His head swelled up to twice the size of a normal head. I'd never seen anything like it, and I hope I never do again. Terry wanted to go in and sit with him when she found out about it. We had a fight over it. I didn't think she should see him like that. I didn't think she should see him, and I still don't.
Who won the fight?
Laura said.
I was in the room with him when he died, Terry said. He never came up out of it, but I sat with him. He didn't have anyone else.
He was dangerous, Mel said. If you call that love, you can have it.
It was love, Terry said. Sure, it's abnormal in most people's eyes, but he was willing to die for it. He did die for it.
I sure as hell wouldn't call it love, Mel said. I mean, no one knows what he did it for. I've seen a lot of suicides, and I couldn't say anyone ever knew what they did it for. Mel put his hands behind his neck and tilted his chair back. I'm not interested in that kind of love, he said. If that's love, you can have it. Terry said,
We were afraid. Mel even made a will out and wrote to his brother in California, who used to be a Green Beret. Mel told him who to look for if something happened to him.
Terry drank from her glass. She said,
But Mel's right. We lived like fugitives. We were afraid.
Mel was, weren't you, honey?
I even called the police at one point, but they were no help. They said they couldn't do anything until Ed actually did something. Isn't that a laugh? Terry said.
She poured the last of the gin into her glass and waggled the bottle. Mel got up from the table and went to the cupboard. He took down another bottle.
Well, Nick and I know what love is, Laura said. For us, I mean, Laura said.
She bumped my knee with her knee.
You're supposed to say something now,
Laura said and turned her smile on me. For an answer, I took Laura's hand and raised it to my lips. I made a big production out of kissing her hand. Everyone was amused. We're lucky, I said.
You guys, Terry said. Stop that now. You're making me sick. You're still on the honeymoon, for God's sake. You're still gaga for crying out loud. Just wait. How long have you been together now? How long has it been? A year? Longer than a year?
Going on a year and a half,
Laura said, flushed and smiling.
Oh, now, Terry said. Wait a while.
She held her drink and gazed at Laura.
I'm only kidding, Terry said.
Mel opened the gin and went around the table with the bottle.
Here, you guys, he said. Let's have a toast. I want to propose a toast. A toast to love. To true love, Mel said.
We touched glasses. To love, we said. Outside in the backyard, one of the dogs began to bark. The leaves of the aspen that leaned past the window ticked against the glass. The afternoon sun was like a presence in this room. This spacious light of ease and generosity. We could have been anywhere, somewhere enchanted. We raised our glasses again and grinned at each other like children who had agreed on something forbidden.
I'll tell you what real love is, Mel said.
I mean, I'll give you a good example, and then you can draw your own conclusions. He poured more gin into his glass. He added an ice cube and a sliver of lime. We waited and sipped our drinks. Laura and I touched knees again. I put a hand on her warm thigh and left it there.
What do any of us really know about love? Mel said. It seems to me we're just beginners at love. We say we love each other, and we do, I don't doubt it. I love Terry, and Terry loves me. And you guys love each other, too. You know the kind of love I'm talking about now. Physical love, that impulse that drives you to someone special, as well as love of the other person's being, his or her essence, as it were. Carnal love and, well, call it sentimental love, the day-to-day caring about the other person. But sometimes I have a hard time accounting for the fact that I must have loved my first wife, too. But I did, I know I did. So I suppose I am like Terry in that regard. Terry and Ed. He thought about it, and then he went on. There was a time when I thought I loved my first wife more than life itself. But now I hate her guts. I do. How do you explain that? What happened to that love? What happened to it is what I'd like to know. I wish someone could tell me. Then there's Ed. Okay, we're back to Ed. He loves Terry so much he tries to kill her, and he winds up killing himself.
Mel stopped talking and swallowed from his glass.
You guys have been together 18 months, and you love each other. It shows all over you. You glow with it. But you both loved other people before you met each other. You've both been married before, just like us. And you probably loved other people before that, too, even. Terry and I have been together 5 years, been married for 4. And the terrible thing is, but the good thing, too, the saving grace, you might say, is that if something happened to one of us, excuse me for saying this, but if something happened to one of us tomorrow, I think the other person, would grieve for a while, you know, but then the surviving party would go out and love again, have someone else soon enough. All of this love we're talking about, it would just be a memory. Maybe not even a memory. Am I wrong? Am I way off base? Because I want you to set me straight if you think I'm wrong. I want to know. I mean, I don't know anything, and I'm the first one to admit it.
Mel, for God's sake, Terry said.
She reached out and took hold of his wrist.
Are you getting drunk, honey? Are you drunk?
Honey, I'm just talking, Mel said. All right, I don't have to be drunk to say what I think. I mean, we're all just talking, right? Mel said. He fixed his eyes on her.
Sweetie, I'm not criticizing, Terry said.
She picked up her glass. I'm not on call today, Mel said. Let me remind you of that. I am not on call, he said.
Mel, we love you, Laura said.
Mel looked at Laura. He looked at her as if he could not place her, as if she was not the woman she was. Love you too, Laura, Mel said. And you, Nick, love you too. You know something? Mel said. You guys are our pals, Mel said. He picked up his glass. Mel said, I was going to tell you about something. I mean, I was going to prove a point. You see, this happened a few months ago, but it's still going on right now, and it ought to make us feel ashamed when we talk like we know what we're talking about when we talk about love.
Come on now, Terry said. Don't talk like you're drunk if you're not drunk.
Just shut up for once in your life, Mel said very quietly. Will you do me a favor and do that for a minute? So as I was saying, there's this old couple who had this car wreck out on the interstate. A kid hit them, and they were all torn to shit, and nobody was giving them much chance to pull through. Terry looked at us and then back at Mel. She seemed anxious, or maybe that's too strong a word. Mel was handing the bottle around the table. I was on call that night, Mel said. It was May, or maybe it was June. Terry and I had just sat down to dinner when the hospital called. There'd been this thing out on the interstate. Drunk kid, teenager, plowed his dad's pickup into this camper with this old couple in it. They were in their mid-70s, that couple. The kid, 18, 19-something, he was DOA, taking the steering wheel through his sternum. The old couple, they were alive, you understand. I mean, just barely. But they had everything. Multiple fractures, internal injuries, hemorrhaging, contusions, lacerations, the works. And they each of them had themselves concussions. They were in a bad way, believe me. And of course, their age was 2 strikes against them. I'd say she was worse off than he was. Ruptured spleen along with everything else. Both kneecaps broken. But they'd been wearing their seatbelts, and God knows that's what saved them for the time being.
Folks, this is an advertisement for the National Safety Council, Terry said. This is your spokesman, Dr. Melvin R. McGinnis, talking.
Terry laughed.
Mel, she said. Sometimes you're just too much. But I love you, hon, she said.
Honey, I love you, Mel said. He leaned across the table. Terry met him halfway. They kissed. Terry's right, Mel said as he settled himself again. Get those seatbelts on. But seriously, they were in some shape, those oldsters. By the time I got down there, the kid was dead, as I said. He was off in a corner, laid out on a gurney.
I took one look at the old couple and told the ER nurse to get me a neurologist and an orthopedic man and a couple of surgeons down there right away. He drank from his glass. "I'll try to keep this short," he said. So we took the two of them up to the OR and worked like fuck on them most of the night. They had these incredible reserves, those two. You see that once in a while. So we did everything that could be done. And toward morning, we're giving them a 50-50 chance, maybe less than that for her. So here they are, still alive the next morning. So, okay, we move them into the ICU, which is where they both kept plugging away at it for 2 weeks, hitting it better and better on all the scopes. So we transfer them out to their own room. Mel stopped talking. "Here," he said. "Let's drink this cheapo gin the hell up. Then we're going to dinner, right? Terry and I know a new place. That's where we'll go, to this new place we know about. But we're not going until we finish up this cut-rate lousy gin." Terry said,
"We haven't actually eaten there yet, but it looks good. From the outside, you know."
"I like food," Mel said. "If I had to do it all over again, I'd be a chef, you know? Right, Terry?" Mel said. He laughed. He fingered the ice in his glass. "Terry knows," he said. "Terry can tell you. But let me say this. If I could come back again in a different life, a different time and all, you know what? I'd like to come back as a knight. You were pretty safe wearing all that armor. It was all right being a knight until gunpowder and muskets and pistols came along."
"Mel would like to ride a horse and carry a lance," Terry said.
"Carry a woman's scarf with you everywhere," Laura said.
"Or just a woman," Mel said.
"Shame on you," Laura said.
Terry said, "Suppose you came back as a serf. The serfs didn't have it so good in those days," Terry said.
"The serfs never had it good," Mel said. "But I guess even the knights were vessels to someone. Isn't that the way it worked? But then everyone is always a vessel to someone. Isn't that right, Terry? But what I liked about knights, besides their ladies, was that they had that suit of armor, you know, and they couldn't get hurt very easy. No cars in those days, you know? No drunk teenagers to tear into your ass."
"Vassals,"
Terry said.
"What?" Mel said.
"Vassals," Terry said. "They were called vassals, not vessels."
"Vassals, vessels," Mel said. "What the fuck's the difference? You knew what I meant anyway." "All right," Mel said. "So I'm not educated. I learned my stuff. I'm a heart surgeon, sure, but I'm just a mechanic. I go in and I fuck around and I fix things. Shit," Mel said.
"Modesty doesn't become you," Terry said.
"He's just a humble sawbones," I said. "But sometimes they suffocated in all that armor, Mel. They'd even have heart attacks if it got too hot and they were too tired and worn out. I read somewhere that they'd fall off their horses and not be able to get up because they were too tired to stand with all that armor on them. They got trampled by their own horses sometimes."
"That's terrible," Mel said. "That's a terrible thing, Nikki. I guess they'd just lay there and wait until somebody came along and made a shish kebab out of them."
"Some other vessel," Terry said.
"That's right," Mel said. "Some vassal would come along and spear the bastard in the name of love. Or whatever the fuck it was they fought over in those days."
"Same things we fight over these days," Terry said.
Laura said,
"Nothing's changed."
The color was still high in Laura's cheeks. Her eyes were bright. She brought her glass to her lips. Mel poured himself another drink. He looked at the label closely as if studying a long row of numbers. Then he slowly put the bottle down on the table and slowly reached for the tonic water.
"What about the old couple?"
Laura said.
"You didn't finish that story you started."
Laura was having a hard time lighting her cigarette. Her matches kept going out. The sunshine inside the room was different now, changing, getting thinner. But the leaves outside the window were still shimmering, and I stared at the pattern they made on the panes and on the formica counter. They weren't the same patterns, of course. "What about the old couple?" I said.
"Older but wiser," Terry said.
Mel stared at her. Terry said,
"Go on with your story, hun. I was only kidding. Then what happened?"
"Terry, sometimes," Mel said.
"Please, Mel," Terry said. "Don't always be so serious, sweetie. Can't you take a joke?"
"Where's the joke?" Mel said. He held his glass and gazed steadily at his wife.
"What happened?"
Laura said. Mel fastened his eyes on Laura. He said, "Laura, if I didn't have Terry, and if I didn't love her so much, and if Nick wasn't my best friend, I'd fall in love with you. I'd carry you off, honey," he said.
"Tell your story," Terry said. "Then we'll go to that new place, okay?"
"Okay," Mel said. "Where was I?" he said. He stared at the table, and then he began again. "I dropped in to see each of them every day, sometimes twice a day if I was up doing other calls anyway. Casts and bandages head to foot, the both of them. You know you've seen it in the movies. That's just the way it looked, just like in the movies. Little eye holes and nose holes and mouth holes. And she had to have her legs slung up on top of it. Well, the husband was very depressed for the longest while. Even after he found out that his wife was going to pull through, he was still very depressed. Not about the accident, though. I mean, the accident was one thing, but it wasn't everything. I'd get up to his mouth hole, you know,